Hi there, I'm Ingrid Backstrom, and you're listening to the Snow Brains Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Snow Brains Podcast, where it's my job to interview the most intelligent people in the snow sports industry and pass their fascinating knowledge on to you, our listeners. I'm your host, Miles Clark. I'm a professional free skier, a professional mountain guide, a UC Berkeley molecular cell biology graduate, the founder and CEO of Snow Brains. And just after college, I went to Baja California, Mexico with Tommy and Biggs from the Cal Ski team. Of course there were no waves, so of course we ended up with fireworks and beer on the beach at night. I lit off a huge, sparkling mortar that arced high and dropped low, catching some low-lying brush on fire near the houses up on the tall cliff. Tommy and Biggs sprinted up the cliff and proceeded to frantically stamp out the fire. I quickly realized that all I had to do was simply light another mortar. Gorgeous and hilarious fire rained down on Tommy and Biggs from above as they attempted to control the fire already burning around them. Their clothes had small black holes on them the rest of the trip. It was a classic ski team moment, and one that they definitely got me back for. Today's Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by Tamarack Resort. Nestled in the west central mountains of Idaho, Tamarack boasts 1,100 acres of terrain, 2,800 vertical feet, and an independent spirit and community vibe unmatched in the West. Today's Snow Brains Podcast is brought to you by Scott Sports. Technology, innovation, and design is the name of the game, and that's exactly what Scott Sports is. It's in their DNA. Skiing is about testing yourself, seeing the possibilities that you're presented with, and pushing yourself to seize the greatest challenges. Scott Sports has the gear to help you do just that. To learn more, check out scottsports.com and see what real innovation looks like. My guest today is Ingrid Backstrom. Ingrid is a legendary free skier who made a huge impact on the ski industry and forever changed free skiing. She started out dominating the North American free skiing competitions, ending up on the podium 12 of the 14 contests she entered. After getting noticed by the owners of Matchstick Productions while winning a free skiing comp in Crested Butte, Colorado, Ingrid exploded onto the free skiing scene in 2004 and has never looked back. After her very first ski movie with Matchstick Productions, it was the 2004 movie Yearbook, Ingrid took home both Best Female Performance and Breakthrough Performance at the 2005 Powder Awards. Ingrid won Powder Magazine's Reader Poll every single year from 2005 to 2015. Ingrid's aggressive, hard-charging, graceful, seemingly effortless style simply blew people's minds on the big screen. Ingrid has also proven herself on some of Earth's highest mountains, skiing off 26,000-foot Gashurim 2 in the Himalaya and harvesting the first descent of 20,000-foot Red Domain in China, not to mention her first descents in Greenland, Baffin Island, and elsewhere. Ingrid's humble background of spending weekends in a 1954 bookmobile turned RV in the Crystal Mountain, Washington parking lot and ski racing at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington are fascinating and pivotal to her success. Ingrid has been in over 20 ski movies and was even included in ESPN's 50 Most Influential People in Action Sports in 2013. Ingrid was a joy to speak with, and we learned a lot about life in chatting with her, and we're confident that you will as well. Hello, Ingrid. Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Miles, for having me. It's good to see you. It's been a long time.
It has been a long time. When did you ski last?
I last skied in April last year in Alaska, actually.
Oh, nice. How was it?
Not good.
Did you go late April?
It was like April 20th, and I think it was 70 degrees in Juneau.
Yeah. Okay. You were down there. Yeah. I was in Alaska at the same time, and it was cooking.
Yeah. It was really hot, but I did get some good turns a little bit earlier in April in Alaska, so I cannot complain at all.
No, I'm sure you can. And you've had so many trips. How many times have you been to Alaska, you think?
I don't know. That would be a good question.
Great. Well, honestly, I have so many questions to ask you. You're one of my all-time favorite skiers.
And every time I ran into you as a kid at Squaw Valley Palisades Tahoe, you were always very kind to me. And I always appreciated that. How many days do you ski per year?
It's gotten a lot less now with two kids, but I don't know. I try to go for, I have no idea, actually. It's at least 50, but hopefully more.
Yeah. How many do you think you used to ski before kids?
Oh man, 100 for sure.
Yeah, that seems to be like the benchmark. What do you think is your biggest accomplishment in skiing?
That's such a hard question. I think still being able to be doing it as a professional is something I'm really proud of. And being mostly safe. One of the coolest things though that I have to say is skiing off Mount Rainier with my whole family.
And
my parents actually didn't ski down. They walked down, but my brothers and I skied off and we all summited together. And that was just a really special trip. So yeah, in terms of my own personal proud moments, that's one of the best.
What do you think is your biggest accomplishment in life?
I guess having a family feels like a big accomplishment for me.
It's huge.
after being a ski bum for so long and chasing snow all over the world and not thinking about anyone except for myself, to be able to pull it off and have two amazing kids and be a mom feels pretty great.
Nice. Yeah, that's impressive. To still be skiing like you do and have a big family like that, that's amazing.
Thanks. It's fun.
And how do you define yourself?
I mean, I guess, yeah, I'm a skier and a mom and a wife and a daughter. I'm mainly about the relationships that I have with people. I'm a member of a community here in a small town in Washington and a member of the ski and snowboard community at large. And I just care a lot about people and making connections and finding common ground.
Where's your favorite place to ski?
Washington.
Nice. And if you had to pick a couple of favorite mountain ranges, what would they be?
The Cascades.
Yes.
In Washington. And of course, the Coast Range of BC.
And what do you think you'd do if you couldn't ski anymore?
I'd probably try to get near the ocean.
Nice. Do you like to surf?
I do. I'm terrible at it, but I just like being in the ocean. I don't know. I think, you know, it's about mountains and the ocean, something about feeling like you're connected to something that's a bit bigger and that kind of force of energy. Yeah, just feels right.
I agree. I surf like a donkey, but I think it's my favorite sport.
Yeah, it's so fun. And it's always challenging, which keeps it fun.
Oh man. And I feel like when you're at the level that we might be at, you get better every day, which is really exciting.
Exactly. If there's something to be said at really sucking at something, because skiing, it takes so long to see an improvement in anything I'm working on at this point. But with surfing, it's like tiny little things. I can feel like woohoo, that's the best thing ever.
I agree. And yeah. What scares you the most in the mountains?
Avalanches.
What do you love most in the mountains?
The freedom of it and the fresh air, just being outside for that many hours a day in the winter, breathing fresh air.
What's the funniest accident you think you've had in the mountains?
One that comes to mind right off the bat is when the day filming for a Matchstick Productions movie, and I was out in the backcountry with Scott Gaffney and Rory Bushfield, and we had snowmobiled the way into the backcountry. I borrowed someone's sled. I was like renting a friend of a friend's sled for the day. We went out and I crashed.
Ooh.
And they were like, oh, you're fine. You probably just tore a calf muscle. And I was like, I don't know. I think I tore my Achilles.
Ooh.
And so we had to get out of the backcountry. In the process, I caught my snowmobile on fire.
No.
It burned to the ground.
What? And that's not possible.
Yeah, no. And then so we got out and finally dragged the pieces out of the broken snowmobile, got out, and I had torn my Achilles tendon.
Oh, fully?
Yeah, fully torn it and burned the snowmobile to the ground in the same day.
That is a terrible day. But I'm glad that you could see that as your funniest accident in the mountains.
Well, it's funny now looking back. Rory just like could not stop laughing the whole day. He was just like, what? And so it was a good lesson, because at a certain point when things are going that bad, what can you do except for laugh?
I like that.
I mean,
I like that.
We were all safe. I mean, I was injured, but in terms of like the bigger picture, we were all safe. It was just a snowmobile and injuries heal. And yeah, at that point, like when things are going so bad, you can only laugh.
And I love that it wasn't even your snowmobile. You burnt somebody else's snowmobile.
No, yeah, I had to pay him back. It was bad.
Oh, it's a pain, especially when you're younger. So you had to pay for the snowmobile, it was just painful. And then what year was that? How old were you when you blew your Achilles, and how long did that take to heal?
Let's see. I think that must have been 2010.
Okay. So a while ago
or 2011. Yeah, it was probably 10 years ago.
And what was the recovery?
The recovery was, I was actually skiing less than 6 months later in Chile. Wow. Yep, in South America, because basically a ski boot is the same as a walking cast.
Right.
And you're not using your calf at all, really. So yeah, the recovery wasn't great. I kind of overstretched it during PT, and I still don't have as big of a calf on that side. I think they've learned a lot since then about Achilles recovery, and there's better processes now. But yeah, so I was skiing. I just shoved that thing right back into a ski boot and went to Chile.
You are such a badass. Cause yeah, you know, a lot of the professional basketball players, that's a 12-month sentence, you know? But like you're saying, they have to do so much more with their ankle than a skier does because of the boot.
Yep. It happens, I guess, to hockey players, and the same thing. They just put it back in the boot and go.
Not much phases hockey players.
No.
Nice. And what was the scariest accident you've had in the mountains?
Yeah, I've seen a lot of scary accidents, I guess. Yeah, I don't know if it's even appropriate to talk about, but I was at Squaw skiing White Towers the day that CR died. Oh. I was right there.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
So, yeah, I mean, I don't know how scary you want to get, but that's like pretty much the worst.
That's scary. Yeah. And so if our listeners don't know, CR Johnson was a very famous pro skier who was I don't even know how you say it, a breakthrough skier. He did a lot of things that we'd done before. From Squaw Valley Palisades, Tahoe, and he had a head injury. And then when he recovered, he ended up crashing in Light Towers, and Ingrid was there, and he passed away.
It was really sad. There was a bunch of us there because it was one of those days where we were all out just lapping, one of those sneaker pow days, and just one of those things that probably most people might have had a head injury from that and recovered. But since he'd had a prior head injury, it was just kind of, couldn't withstand it. Super sad. CR was great.
Yeah, I'd only met him a couple of times, but yeah, definitely an inspiration. And on that note, how many friends have you lost in the mountains?
It's so many. I mean, really hard to count them all, actually.
A lot of us who live in the mountains full time, we've all lost a lot of friends in the mountains, and it's hard to talk about.
Yeah, and it's hard to kind of reconcile, like, how can we still do it? And I mean, I think about it a lot, so I don't mind talking about it, but yeah, it's definitely a downer. It's one of those things where we all like to just wish that side of the sport didn't happen. But I think it is important to talk about that this is something we're choosing to do that's very risky. And I think it is important for people to talk about it more and realize that there are a lot of inherent risks in the sport of skiing.
Yeah. And it's interesting the process we all go through, because it does seem to be so individualized on how we cope with our grief and move forward. And how do we get past these things? And for me, you know, I know you lost a brother in the mountains. I lost my brother when I was skiing. I was 19 and he was 13, skiing in California. And it's just, it changed me fundamentally. And it's made me a better person. And so I, you know, there's the good with the bad, and none of us want it to happen, but there are ways to reconcile and learn and move forward that can make you a better person.
Yeah. I agree. I'm so sorry. I didn't know that, Miles.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's something I didn't talk about a lot when I was younger. And it's something that I've gotten more comfortable with. And I think it's better for me to talk about my brother, because when I didn't talk about him, it was like he didn't exist. And now I try to bring him out and show people who he was. And that feels a lot better.
Yeah, I agree. It is. I'm getting to that place where I don't talk a lot about it on social media or anything like that, just because it feels so private. And figuring out a way to talk about and not, like, because Arnie was so much more than just his accident and his death. And like, you want to talk about the person that they were during life and not just have it reduced to like, oh my gosh, Ingrid lost her brother. It's this terrible thing. And you don't want people's pity. I just want to like be able to talk about my brother.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where I'm at with it. You know, like the accident isn't important to me anymore. Right. It still has, there's still a scar there. It's more like, I just talk about him and my brother, Nathan, as a person. Like, this is what he was into. This is what we did together. And that's what feels good.
Right. And okay. So I have a question. If you just meet someone and you're talking to them and it's casual at a party or something, and someone says, Miles, how many brothers, do you have brothers and sisters? Yeah. How many do you have? What do you say?
And that actually is like, I'm getting an emotional response from that because I used to take one sibling out of that number.
Yeah.
So I used to be like, hey, I'm the oldest of six and talk about, you know, the other ones. Cause I just didn't want to hit it. And now I don't do that. And a lot of times when people ask me to individualize those people, I go, all right, well, my sister does this. My brother passed away when I was a kid. We were skiing together. And then, you know, and I go through the other ones and they always, you know, say, hey, I'm so sorry about your brother. And I say, hey, that's okay. And often, you know, if it's somebody I don't know, I don't go any further, but I also don't like omitting him as a person because he was there and he made an impact and he changed me.
Yeah, that's how I feel. I'm like, I have it. Yeah. For a long time, I would just say, oh, I have one brother. He lives in California. But now I'm like, I have two brothers.
Good for you. Yeah. And that's so interesting that we have the same experience there. And I don't think that's uncommon. I bet a lot of people go through this process.
Yeah. Cause right when you're meeting someone, you don't want to just like drop a turd in the punch bowl
the second you meet them.
So you have to kind of read the room, I guess, but yeah.
And then, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Brené Brown, you probably heard of her. She does a lot of work with vulnerability and courage and all that. And one of her things that she talks about is floodlighting. And sometimes when you overshare right in some, you know, right when you meet somebody, it just turns them away and freaks them out. So, you know, you also have to balance all that. So you also don't want to be like, hey, you know, this terrible thing happened. Let me tell you all about it. You know, but I don't want to omit him. You know, I want to say, hey, this was a person that I was close to, is not here anymore. You know, and that's about as far as I'll go with somebody I don't know. But then, you know, usually then once I get to know somebody, we'll get into it. And then I really like to show that person. And this is how that experience changed me. And this is how I've improved since then. And now this is how I've changed since then. Because for me, it was like, you could look at my life as some sort of line and there's a huge kink in it. And my life changes direction at that moment in time.
That's so funny. I always describe it as like, before I lost my brother, it was like, there's an X and Y axis and like life kind of goes up like this. And you just kind of always figure it's going to always go mostly this way. Those would be some dips, but now I'm like, oh, we're like underneath the axis at this point. Like life is like not just between the X and the Y. It's like all this other stuff over here. And there's so much more going on that you have no idea until you have an experience like that.
I agree. And it's really challenging and it really helps you build. And I really don't sweat the small stuff anymore. I was very bizarre for about 2 years. And it was a challenging time during college and, you know, sort of adolescent still. And so it was, I'm sure that you went through the same.
Yeah. It was like instant empathy for me because I was in Italy at the time when I found out and I had to travel home all by myself. Ooh. And I just remember walking through the airport being like, wow, I will never like look around and just take for granted that all these people are having a good day or that what a jerk or that person cut me off or whatever. Like you never know what that person's going through on that day. And so it just made me think instant, like different thoughts about all the strangers around me going about life.
I agree. I feel the same. It's you know, somebody told me once, if everybody threw their problems out into the street, you'd go diving onto the ground to get yours back.
Right. Yeah, totally.
You just don't know what people are going through. And a lot of times it's a lot more than you could even deal with. How many avalanches have you been in?
Well, I've never been buried in an avalanche, knock on wood. I've been kind of dragged down the mountain a couple times and I've gotten caught and been able to dig myself or kind of like punch in and keep myself in one spot. And then I've outran a couple. Gosh, it sounds terrible when I say all. I mean, I've gotten so lucky and I was so naive. I think it was also just the culture that I was wrapped up in at the time. I was like, oh, you just outrun it. You get swept up in it. Oh, it's just a short pitch. If it rips, you'll be fine. All those things that we kind of tell ourselves. And I was just young and naive and didn't want to question the people I was with and seem like a wimp.
I feel like sometimes when you're young, you just think like, I will punch an avalanche in the face.
I'll get out of it. Nothing will happen to me. Exactly.
Totally. Yeah. I had my first avalanche about 2 years ago and it scared the tar out of me. And I think I've always been quite conservative and even more now I am a ski cut king. You don't want to ski with me because I'll be ski cutting 3 or 4 times. And you told us.
That's the person I want to ski with. I'm like, oh, you check my beacon again. I love skiing with you. Like whip that thing out. Check me again. That's great.
Especially as you get older, you know, it's like, hey, I just want to get home.
Totally.
You told us about your Achilles, but have you ever been hurt in other ways while skiing?
Oh yeah, I tore my Achilles tendon, and then I've also torn both patellar tendons.
Oh my
separate
gosh.
Incidences. I know. I don't know what it is. My
Those
tendons.
The biggest ligaments in your body or tendons in your body you've torn.
Yep. Yeah, I have. The first one, I was in the backcountry in BC. I was out sledding with the Sherpa's crew, and I just like went down these pillows. I've always kind of had patellar tendinosis.
Uh-huh.
So my patellar tendons were always a little sore. And at one point I went and saw a doctor in Canada, a Canadian ski team doctor. And he was like, oh, you'll never tear your patellar tendon.
Ooh.
Like you can just take Advil, work through it. It'll be fine. And so that's what I did. I just kind of skied through the pain for a lot of years. And then I totally tore it.
Oh, and how did you tear it? You said you were skiing pillows and they both tore it once?
I was skiing pillows and it was just like a flat landing. Oh, and I landed and I only tore one that time and I healed from that and came back pretty well, actually. And then the second one, this is another one of those like funny, not funny stories. I was 4 months pregnant with our second daughter.
Oh no.
And I know. Don't do this at home, kids. We had been working on getting All In, the movie made with Matchstick.
And oh, yeah, great movie.
All women's movie, and we've been working on it for 2 years, and I got pregnant, and it was just one of those life things, whatever. And so I was like, well, I'll have a month to film, I'll be 4 months pregnant, it'll be fine. And so we went out on our first day filming, and I went off in air and hit a hard landing and tore my patellar tendon.
Oh no.
Yeah,
well, I guess that that kept you home and convalescent during your pregnancy a bit.
Totally. I mean, gosh. I think my mindset at the time was such that like, we finally got this project, I gotta go, and it was one of those times when life just is like, no honey, you're getting way too big for your britches and you just need to like sit on the couch for a little bit,
chill the fuck out.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. So that was pretty, in retrospect, I was for sure pushing through the pain, not listening to my body, not listening to all these signs, just because I had that huge chip on my shoulder.
Interesting. And tell me a little bit about the chip on your shoulder.
I mean, I think it's probably why I wanted to be a pro skier in the first place. I think I just always had this idea that I wanted to be able to do the same things that guys got to do. Like I was always the kid on the playground that was trying to play football. So then I started skiing. And ironically, it was a bunch of women that inspired me. Like I saw Jamie Burge in a ski movie and I want to be like her. And so it was kind of both. I wanted to prove that I could ski some of the same stuff the guys were skiing. And I also wanted to be like a woman like Jamie or like Wendy Fisher or all those rad women that kind of blaze the path.
That is awesome. Thank you so much for sharing that with me. I think the chip on the shoulder is looked down on a little bit in our society, but I've met so many amazing people that the chip on the shoulder is why they're where they got to. It got them through, drove them through so much in life. And I had somebody much wiser than myself once tell me, never tell your enemies what they cannot do. Because anytime somebody tells me what I can't do, it's like, I will stop everything to now do that thing you're saying I can't do. And it feels like that might've been part of your inspiration, especially in this male dominated industry.
Yeah, for sure. And part of it's like a curiosity of I'm endlessly curious of what can I get away with? How far can I push it? I mean, I think some of that hopefully has subsided and I feel the chip on my shoulder less nowadays, which is actually really nice. It's nice to be like, you know what? I'm going to say no to that line. And I'm not even going to think twice about it. I don't even care.
Well, and I, from my perspective, Ingrid, the reason that you don't have as much of a chip on your shoulder is that you very much proved yourself to the world and we all enjoyed the piss out of watching you do it. So thank you for that. So that sounds like you're in a good spot. So I'm happy to hear that. You've been on ski trips all over the world. Where was your favorite ski trip?
Ooh, one of my very favorites was to Baffin Island.
Could you tell us a little bit about that trip? Because, you know, Andrew McLean, who I think you know, he told me about that. He said it was the coolest trip he's ever been on.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the tallest cliffs in the world and some of the longest chutes in the world. And I'd love to hear what your experience was like.
Yeah, well, it was a North Face trip. It was soon after I got onto the North Face team. And we were sitting around at breakfast at some meeting. And Jimmy Chin goes, oh, I have this trip to Baffin Island and I can't go on it. And I was sitting there with Hillary Nelson and Kasha Rigby. And they were like, oh, can we go?
Whoa.
And so kind of the manager, the like marketing manager was like, oh, sure. I mean, the budget's already set aside. Yeah. Whoa. And I was like, can I come? I'm like, yeah. So I didn't even know what I was getting into. But I was just like in that mode of say yes. And I had seen Andrew McLean's slideshow about Baffin Island.
Oh, he has the best slideshows.
Yeah, he's amazing. And I was like, I need to go to that place. And so it was myself, Hillary, Kasha, and Meg Oster. And we had an entire TV crew with us.
Whoa.
So that part was a little bit ridiculous. But yeah, basically Baffin Island, we flew into this tiny outpost called Clyde River. And we had these Inuit guides. And we took snowmobiles. And they pull you in basically a giant wooden box on runners. It's called a kumatik. And you just sit in that. And they pull you over the snow. I think a lot of people use kites and just skin, but with the TV crew, they were like, no, we're not doing that. So we brought kites. Yeah, we brought kites and we used them a little bit, but being with the Inuit guides out on the ice. And then, I mean, at one point, our very first night on the ice, I went to go pee behind another tent and I got back and the guide was like, never walk out of our sight again. Oh. We're out here on the edge of the ice and there's polar bears all around and they're like stalking us and they're waiting exactly for that second for you to walk away.
Whoa.
Yeah. So they always had guns. And then once you get into the fjords out of the open ocean, the polar bears don't come in there quite as much. There's always that to think about. And then just the couloirs were absolutely amazing. You know, 2,000 to 5,000 foot couloirs straight up. Whoa. Off the flat frozen fjords that you're camping on. We were there on the ice. We camped out for 21 days and we skied 19 couloirs.
No way. Well, you guys must have been exhausted.
Yeah, but it was the most energy I think I've ever had. I still had that chip on my shoulder, like we were talking about. And it never really got dark.
Yeah.
It would kind of get dark for 2 hours in the night and you could sleep whenever you wanted. And there was just, the couloirs are super easy to boot up. So you could just kind of run up them. And we had an excellent team and we were kind of just firing on all cylinders. It was so beautiful. One of those times when you're like, how can we not go up another couloir right now? Cause there's another one there that hasn't been skied and it's right there.
Yeah. And first descents too, I'm sure.
Yeah, totally. So we got several first descents and yeah, it was just magical.
And did you see some polar bears?
We did. On the very last day when we were going back out from camping out on the fjords, we were going back to Clyde River and one of the Inuit guides on his snowmobile came zipping back and grabbed us and we all got to go out and see the polar bears.
Oh, that's so cool. You know, and that's crazy, your story about the Inuit guide chastising you for basically walking away from camp a little bit. You know, we had Doug Staup on the podcast, you might know, spent a lot of time in the poles. And, you know, he says, according to him, it's the only animal that actively hunts human beings. So, and it sounds like your guides knew that.
Yeah, they did. I mean, we went kiting one day and they were like, so nervous to let us go kiting by ourselves. They made us take a gun with us. We're like, I don't know what we're going to do with this thing if we actually see a polar bear. But they made it clear that it was not to be messed around with and that it was a very serious danger.
So again, you've been everywhere, skied all over. Is there anywhere you would not go back to?
That's an interesting question. I don't think so. Most places I can find some sort of redemptive. I've skied at a tiny ski area way up in northeastern China.
Oh,
you could see North Korea from there.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I don't think I need to go back to that particular ski area.
Right. Sounds challenging there. Was that a part of your Chinese expedition? There's not 20,000 peaks in that area. What were you doing out there?
North Face Asia.
Oh, wow.
Was having an event. And so they brought a couple of us out there to ski and snowboard with people and talk to them about skiing and snowboarding because it's such a growing sport there.
Right.
I mean, it's amazing. They're putting in one new ski area a day or something.
It's crazy. And
they have a goal to have how many millions of people ski by a certain date. So they just brought us to kind of like get people hyped basically on skiing and snowboarding.
That's cool. I like that. I feel like that encompasses your mindset a little bit, is that the one place you wouldn't go back to was also awesome.
It was.
How many ski movies have you been in and which was your favorite?
Oh, good question. I think I've been in over 20. I'm not exactly, I haven't counted them in a while. Which one was my favorite? It's got to be Yearbook, the first one, because it was just so exciting and new. And I was with Shane and we went to Bella Coola and the whole thing where I was just like, this cannot be real life right now. I can't believe I'm in these mountains. And also we had kind of the best conditions on that trip that I've ever experienced.
Yeah. Tell us about that trip.
It was myself, Scott Gaffney, Shane McConkey, and then Hugo Harrison was there for part of it. And Mark Abma. Yep. Hugo was amazing. And we got there and then we proceeded to sit in the fog and in the weather for 3 weeks.
Whoa. That's a long time. That's extreme.
Yeah, we were playing basketball every day. We went snorkeling down the river. We got dry suits and like snorkeled down the river. We were going hiking every day. I mean, we were like, Shane, of course, makes everything fun. He's not going to have a boring day.
That's lucky.
But then we finally got out and it was the most perfect conditions. It was not even any slush. It was like, you know, when it's that Tahoe and it's that perfect kind of just wet enough pow that it sticks to everything, but it's still really fun to ski.
Yeah, and maybe a little wind pressed.
A teeny bit, yeah, like bouncy pow, but you could ski anything you wanted. It was perfect, stable, and we could ski the steepest lines and not even any slough to deal with.
Wow, that sounds like an all-time trip. I can't even really imagine what it's like to not ski steep lines and not have it slough. It just sounds weird.
It was super weird, but I mean, I didn't know any different. It was my first time getting on lines like that. And I was like, this is sweet. Let's do it again. Like, what are you guys talking about? And they were kind of like, oh, I point at the line I want to do. And they're like, no, you need to pick something over here.
Uh-huh.
I was like, whatever. They're making me ski the chick line or whatever. And I went up and looked down the line. I was like, oh, whoa. All right. Okay. I guess I better keep my mouth shut a little bit and like maybe listen to what they're saying.
But obviously you progressed during that trip and I'm guessing you got a handful of good days in. I assume you filmed other places as well, but that was what was so nuts is that was 2004 yearbook Matchstick Productions. It was your first ski movie. And then if I'm not mistaken, at the Powder Video Awards, you got best female performance and best breakthrough performance. So that's insane. So that must have been, I mean, what did that feel like going through that whole experience and then getting those awards as well?
I don't know. I mean, again, I was so new to it that I didn't really know what that meant. I was just like, cool, this is sweet. So I get to keep doing this. Like someone's going to pay me to ski. You know, it was just so unbelievable to me. And my friends and I have talked about it like for so long. If I was sitting on a plane next to someone, they're like, oh, what do you do for work or whatever? And I would just say I'm a waitress because it just seemed so, because I was still waiting tables in Tahoe at that time. But it just seems so unreal and so too good to be true that to admit it seemed like almost that it would just vanish.
And was that a big goal of yours to become a pro skier or did it sort of just materialize and kind of slap you in the face?
It sort of just happened. I think I moved to Tahoe to ski Palisades Tahoe and I just wanted to ski for a year before getting a real job. But in the course of that year, I all of a sudden did some free skiing contests and kind of started meeting people where I was like, oh, these are my people. Everyone's here because they want to be outside and they love the same things. And they're all intelligent, kind, like caring people that are just really passionate about the sport. So at that point, I knew I wanted to have something to do with the ski industry. I thought maybe I'd write or work for a magazine or something. I did an internship at Powder to see if that was the route. In the course of that process, I ended up doing a free skiing contest in Crested Butte and Murray Weiss and Steve Winter from Matchstick were in the audience. I didn't even know they were at the bottom watching. And it was kind of one of those where I had nothing to lose. Cause I was supposed to go to Chamonix with Kip, who was my boyfriend at the time, Kip Gar.
Okay. Yeah.
And we were supposed to go to Chamonix. That was like I'd worked all winter and it was like my last money had been spent on this ticket to Chamonix. We had a place to stay. He had a passes lined up for us. And then on the night before we went, I couldn't find my passport.
Oh no.
So we tore apart my house, his house until 4 a.m, could not find my passport. And so he went to Chamonix and I was just like, wow, I am a total failure. I'm an adult. Like a very small thing, like finding my passport is going to ruin my whole, now I don't have any money. And I'm just going to have to go to work. And like, there goes my whole spring. And we were going to go spend a month in Chamonix. And I just felt like such a loser. But then my friend was like, oh, we're going to Crested Butte for the contest. You want to come? And so I kind of was at that point where you just have nothing to lose. And I ended up going there and kind of had that effort mentality and did a really good line, ended up winning the contest. And I won $6,000.
Whoa.
Was the prize, which at the time I was like, I don't need to work for a year. Like, woo. Yep. I've got it made.
I'm rich.
Yeah, totally. I didn't, Steve and Murray were in the audience from Matchstick and I didn't know that. And then a couple months later they called and said, do you want to come film with us? So it was all kind of just like accidental.
Well, I love that part of life when these, you know, it's the hard times that make us better, not the easy times. And it's sometimes you got to go low to get high. So, you know, you had this ferocious dip of not getting out of Chamonix and then you end up basically in the Matchstick movies, which led to you getting Female of the Year and Best Breakout Performance. I mean, that is a really great lesson for all of us and especially our listeners to grasp onto, because you know, when you're down, it's so easy to just want to stay down. But when you, if you can learn from those down lessons and come back from it and sometimes just have the F it attitude and put your best foot forward. I mean, that's incredible. That's a great story, Ingrid.
It is. And now with even more perspective, I mean, for a long time, that was a cool story for me because I was like, you know what? Something at the time that you think is really bad can turn out being great later on. And there's always a silver lining. Yep. But now with even more hindsight and even more perspective, I realize that a lot of what the story is about is how much support I had and how much I really had going for me in the form of a friend that would loan me money to go to pay the entry fee to Crested Butte, and my parents who I knew I could always, you know, go back and live with them if my dreams fell flat and I was broke or whatever. So how lucky was I to have all that in the first place? So,
I mean, it appears to me that all of this may not have happened for you had you not gone to Crested Butte. So that's really interesting. And was that your first competition? One of your first?
No, I'd done a couple. I'd done some other ones.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'd
done, you had some experience.
Fine. Yeah. I was doing pretty well in the contest, but I'd been doing them for a couple of years and it wasn't really going anywhere. I was kind of like, oh, maybe this will lead to something. Maybe it'll be fun, but nope, it's not really going anywhere. I didn't really have any, you know, as maybe getting like a free pair of goggles or something.
Right.
But I was like, okay, cool. This is fun, but I really need to like do something with my life. I'm not using my brain. I have this college degree. I'm just still waiting tables and being a ski bum. But the irony is at that moment, that was really when it kind of turned around.
Well, you know, because you talked about using your brain, that's a good segue into what I want to talk to you about with you next. And I usually don't really go chronologically with people. And I guess we've already broken that a bit, but I do want to try a little chronology with you here. So I just read on your Wikipedia page that you were the high school valedictorian. Is that right?
Yeah, there was two of us. It was shared. We shared it.
That's amazing. There's not a lot of pro skiers or pro athletes in general who could say that they were a valedictorian of their high school. What I really want to know is, did you work hard for grades in high school or did it come to you easily?
It was pretty easy for me in high school.
Okay.
Relatively, but then I went to college and I got my ass handed to me.
I think a lot of people experience that too, but a lot of the valedictorian, very smart people in high school that I know share your story. They're always like, yeah, I don't know. It was easy. Like I was just like, it was casual. I would study like at a party. You know,
I loved school. Yeah. I loved it. I loved my teachers. I was just so fortunate. I had good support from my parents and they were really encouraging. And, you know, it was also like, there was a lot of pressure from them to do good, but I didn't even need that. I kind of put the pressure on myself and I liked it.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, having those kind of challenges, obviously you like challenges. And so having these kind of challenges is very stimulating and can give you a lot of drive. And it sounds like, did you also play three sports varsity level in high school?
Yeah, I did three sports. And then I was ski racing on the weekend. And
you said played varsity level, three sports and ski race. What were your sports that you played in high school?
Swimming, basketball, and track.
Do you think any of those sports helped you as a skier later on in life?
Possibly. I think basketball, you kind of have to be aggressive and like, there's the training. Swimming, you have to be able to just turn your mind off and do something very monotonous for a long period of time. I mean, yeah, swimmers who are just in the pool for hours a day, just like,
it's impressive.
Now you're not talking to anyone. You're just stroke, stroke, stroke. Yeah. So yeah, I mean, that's funny. I've never thought about it like this, Miles, but
I bet it helps you.
I think I totally did, because I think being able to go to that place in my mind where I was just going to do that thing over and over again and be okay with the pain or the relative suffering of swimming as hard as you can for a couple hours or whatever. Yeah, I think that really helps. And then track, same thing. Yeah, just I think having goals and having training, you have to go every day after school and you just feel you're so hungry after high school. And then you have to go run 5 miles and then do a bunch of wind sprints. Oh.
Impressive. Yeah. Impressive. Yeah. Because I played basketball as well in high school. That was my sport growing up. I was really into basketball until the age of 22. And I think it really helped me because like the discipline, you know, teamwork, which ends up being huge in the mountains. And I think also just that being able to work through pain. My coaches used to really work us hard. But if anything else, obviously athleticism doesn't hurt. They're really training you on all that. But I think the discipline really, really is important when you get into the mountains.
Yeah, 100%. And just learning to like that training and to enjoy that, the payoff where you're going to work really hard at something and then you're going to get to see a payoff later, that kind of really delayed gratification that I think sports is really great for kids to learn.
And got us both addicted to endorphins, I think.
Yeah, probably that too.
And I want to jump into, you know, sort of the next thing that I thought was so interesting, and I might have the year wrong here, but your parents had a 1954 GMC Bookmobile. That they made into a makeshift RV and that you spent a lot of time in the B lot at the Crystal Mountain Ski Resort. And so my understanding is, you know, you grew up in Seattle, Washington. Your parents were ski patrollers at nearby Crystal Mountain. They had a 1954 GMC Bookmobile RV that appears to have been pivotal in your young skiing life. Can you tell us a bit about that Bookmobile and what it did for you?
Well, my parents were on the volunteer patrol. So that was just the weekend, the National Ski Patrol. And so when I think I was probably, we had a rickety old truck and camper before that. And in those days, you could just camp in the parking lot for free.
Right.
At Crystal.
Tell our listeners why people did that.
Well, I mean, then you could stay all weekend. Yeah, there's not like a base village. All the resorts in Washington are on Forest Service land, including the base areas. So they might have a lodge and maybe one hotel. Crystal has maybe two hotels and some random cabins and stuff, but there's nowhere to stay. And the places that are super expensive. So yeah, that was a way where we could stay relatively cheaply, mainly free every weekend and be right. I mean, we were Slopeside, baby.
I love it. I love it. And what was the B lot like? Because I think that's where you stayed at Crystal Mountain. I picture it having like funky culture. And I'm curious what the afternoons and nights consisted of and what the shenanigans were like.
Totally. It was super fun. I mean, you'd ski all day and then all evening you were just outside playing in the snow with all your friends. And it was a lot of other kids whose parents were on the ski patrol or on the volunteer ski patrol. And so there's just a whole pack of kids skiing all day and then sledding and playing in the snow until, you know, we just collapse into bed, get up and do it all over again. And then we'd have to drive the Bookmobile. So a friend of my parents fixed it up. My parents didn't fix it up, but it was
nice.
Yeah. And then they bought it from him, but it slept eight and it was kind of the most heinous looking vehicle you could ever imagine. Like if you imagine a UPS truck, but from 1950s, is that.
It was kind of brown and rusty looking in the pictures.
Yes, totally. Brown and rusty. And, but it was awesome. I mean, what a cool thing. At the time, it was so embarrassing.
Yeah. Tell me about that.
When you're a 14-year-old girl or probably a 14-year-old anyone, you just want to be cool and fit in. And that was not fitting in. I was like driving through the neighborhood, like, please, nobody I know see us. Like, oh, here come the Backstroms. Great.
I just picture like, your parents honking and waving, hey, the kids in the back.
And we're just like hiding in the back. But I mean, now, of course, I look back, I'm like, well, how cool is that? They made it happen on not that much money and made it so we could ski every single weekend.
And it is funky and cultural as possible. I think that's got to be one of the most interesting ski town cultures of all time. Cause it's like a ski town without a ski town. You're just basically car camping everybody. I love it. Cause there's nowhere else to stay. This is how you do it.
Yeah. And it's still, I mean, now you have to pay and stuff, but still the B-lot culture is a thing. People have their Christmas lights, they have their fire pits, they rage and it's awesome.
I love it. I love it. And this was all at Crystal Mountain, Washington, which I don't know anything about. So I really would love to hear your perspective because this is a place that really shaped your skiing. What is skiing at Crystal like and why do you love skiing there?
Well, I love it because I grew up there. So I'm kind of biased, but it is a very unique place. It's 13 miles across the valley from Mount Rainier. So on a clear day, which there aren't that many up here, but on a clear day, you're looking right across at Mount Rainier.
I love that.
So it's super unique. And then you're looking towards the North Cascades and just up in the Cascades. And so Crystal kind of feels like big, expansive mountains, big peaks with lots of long runs off of them. And it feels really spread out. Yet there's a lot of little secret nooks and crannies and forested kind of glades to check out. So it kind of has those alpine peaks, and then it has a lot of tree line stuff as well. Kind of got something for everyone.
I love that. And for our listeners who don't know, Mount Rainier is 14,411 feet, has 26 glaciers on it. It's an absolute beast. It's like a, I don't even know. It looks like the if you smashed the moon into a pile and stuffed it on Earth, it's that big. So seeing it from, you know, she's saying from only 13 miles straight across is a spectacular sight. I love that mountain. And where does Crystal live in your favorite places to ski?
Oh, I mean, it's one of my favorite all-time places to ski. It's where my husband and I got engaged.
Oh,
I just have so many special memories from there and growing up there. And yeah, I love Crystal. And it's just funny that now we live 3 hours away, so I don't get there as much as I like, but I like skiing anywhere. Now we mainly ski Stevens, but because we're really close to that. But
and how,
yeah.
And how do you like Stevens?
I love Stevens, actually. When I first moved here, I was like, oh, it's so small. I don't know how it's ever going to be enough. But then I started learning the area and I was like, oh yeah, this place is awesome.
Nice. I love it. Okay. Well, let's jump into the next stage of your life. You grew up basically in the parking lot at Crystal, running around, skiing like a beast.
Only on the weekends.
On the weekends, valedictorian in high school. And you ended up going to college at Whitman College in Walla Walla, Washington. And Walla Walla is in Eastern Washington, right on the border of Oregon. And it's kind of in the middle of nowhere. And so I'm curious, what was it like living there, especially right after living in Seattle?
Well, it was good. It was kind of like a sheltered little zone, which I really needed when I went off to college, because I was just like a total spaz and like, woohoo, I'm in college. Whitman was a really great place for me to go because there's only 2,000 kids.
Oh,
it's relatively safe. It's a small town and I could just kind of spaz out and I kind of had this sheltered existence. And then all of a sudden here I was at college and I was like, yeah, it was a free for all. So I think in that way, I'm really glad that I went to a place like that because it was relatively safe. Like if I would have been at the UW in downtown Seattle, there's just a lot more ways to get into trouble, I guess.
And so as valedictorian from your high school, I feel like you could have gone to school a myriad of places. And so why did you choose Whitman?
I chose Whitman because I had a scholarship there. I had a really good like half tuition scholarship.
Whoa, congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah. So, and also they had a ski team. They had a really good ski team.
Oh, where did you guys ski?
We skied at Bluewood.
Okay. Where's that?
It's in the Wallawas.
Oh, so did you cross over to Oregon?
No, it's in Washington, okay. But it's about an hour from Walla Walla.
And close.
It's a tiny old double chairlift that takes maybe 15 minutes to get up. And then it's like 30 seconds to ski back down. But it was actually really fun terrain. And for training, for ski racing, it was awesome. And I had an amazing coach who really cared about the skiers and he cared about us as people. He was kind of like that uncle figure looking after all of us. And so I think I stayed because of the ski team, because the people were so great. And we were skiing 5 days a week.
Whoa.
We'd get done with class 3 days a week and go straight to Bluewood and ski until dark. And I think that camaraderie and just that was what really made me realize like, oh, this is what I want. I just love the camaraderie and being with a group of people working towards that common goal.
And that must have really helped. How do you think that ski racing 5 days a week in college helped with your professional skiing career?
I got so much stronger. Yeah, we were doing weight training. I was skiing 5 days a week and all of a sudden it kind of just clicked. Whereas in high school, I was a pretty like mediocre to bad ski racer. Because I didn't start till I was 12 ski racing and most kids started when they were 5. So I was kind of behind the curve. But then in college, yeah, it just kind of clicked. And I started doing a lot better. And by my senior year, yeah, we won nationals and it was awesome.
Oh, congrats. That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. It was super fun. So I got a lot better at skiing and I think my confidence in my skiing improved. And that was when I was really like, oh, I love skiing. And more importantly, my brother, Arnie, was at Whitman at the time. He was a sophomore and he was also on the ski team.
Oh.
And my really good friend, Shauna, that I grew up skiing at Crystal with, they were both at Whitman on the ski team. Wow. And so everyone else would finish their race and go into the lodge and we would just go free skiing.
Ah, perfect.
And they were like, oh, we're not going to the lodge, Ingrid, you got to come with us. And I mean, we were going to McCall, we were going to Brundage, we were traveling all over the Northwest and Idaho and Oregon skiing. And I got to go on awesome ski trips and ski all these places. And I think that was what made me be like, oh, I want to move somewhere and ski, was having those times with Arnie and Shauna just skiing powder after our race runs.
Just from hearing your stories here today, I feel like if I had to point my finger at the one thing that might've been just hugely important for your ski career later on in life, it feels like it was Whitman. And that's something I wouldn't have guessed at. I didn't know you were even on the ski team. Sounds like that's where a lot of that skill, power, and drive, and then obviously free skiing came from. That is so cool to hear.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that. And again, not something I've totally put together like that.
Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Tamarack Resort. You might come to Tamarack for the views that unfold across the valley or the unspoiled terrain and vast open bowls. Maybe you'll come to uncover a place that's a little different, that's down to earth and at home on the path less traveled. But we know you'll come back because there's a community of people at Tamarack who make you feel like you're in the right place at the right time. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Scott Sports. Skip the lift lines this year and get into the backcountry. With all the new Scott Winter Essentials, you're set to have a safe and fun time in the mountains. Check out the new product line at scottsports.com. You studied geology and what was your post-college plan right as you graduated?
Well, I wasn't so sure. The summer before my senior year, I did a geology internship at a firm in Seattle, a geological consulting firm.
Wow.
And I was like, oh boy, yeah, I don't really want to work in geology. It was kind of one of those really good experiences for teaching you what you don't want to do.
Right.
And at that point, I was already in it and I was going to get a geology major. But I went to a liberal arts school and they were like, oh, it doesn't matter what you major in. Just major in what interests you. And then of course you graduate and you realize how much it does matter what you majored in. But geology was cool because we got to go on a lot of field trips and I got to do study abroad in New Zealand my junior year.
Oh man.
They have an amazing geology program and that's the first place I backcountry skied. And yeah, I had an incredible experience in New Zealand. So in a way, yeah, like you pointed out, it's not necessarily school or the geology itself, but those took me to a lot of cool places and enabled a lot of amazing experiences.
So I feel like the next step for you might have been coming down to Lake Tahoe and going to Squaw Valley, which we're now going to call Palisades Tahoe. So after college, you ended up in Squaw. I think you had a plan, or you ended up in Palisades Tahoe. And I think you had a plan of just doing one year of ski bumming and then going back to the real world, which was the same plan I had. And obviously both of our plans got completely train wrecked.
Yeah, for sure. I moved down there. I got a job at the resort at Squaw Creek and I was working in the Sweet Potatoes Deli, making coffee and sandwiches. And then I would like answer phones. I did banquets. I would take whatever job I could, but it was awesome. I got a free ski pass. I had benefits and I was like, I got it made. I thought it was sweet. I mean, I just got my mind blown by the fact that everyone was there to ski and shred. And there's so many good skiers. Everyone's just raging right under the lift.
Yeah.
And I'm a competitive person. So I just got caught up in it all. It's too fun when everyone's launching themselves off the Palisades, which is at the top of Palisades Tahoe, Palisades session or fingers or whatever it is. I think I just got really caught up in that. And my competitive self really liked it. And it was like, oh, now I'm not just a ski bum. I'm like training for something.
Ah.
Now I'm competing. And I think something that people don't talk about too much is when you, like, you did high school sports, maybe sports in college, and then all of a sudden you don't have that competitive outlet. And I think I really miss that because it's such a part of your identity. And so finding free skiing contests where it wasn't racing, it wasn't so rigid, it was just a bunch of people having a good time, that was really cool.
Sounds like a really good paradigm shift for you. So you basically were super competitive and then you didn't have an outlet for that. And then as soon as you got to Squaw, I think is the most competitive place on earth. It's just, it's in your face because literally the way Squaw Palisades Tahoe is designed is basically the lift goes right over all the best terrain. So it's not like nobody's watching you. Some of the biggest nervousness I have when skiing the fingers, for example, is just the crowd. How many chairs are, probably maybe 50 chairs can see you times four. You got like 200 people and then plus all the people online that are, the lifties, everybody's watching you. And of course, you probably experience this too. Your friends are heckling you saying that you're lame and you're going to blow this. And so on its own way, Squaw Palisades Tahoe, it's an intense place to ski.
Yeah, it really is. But I think at that point I really thrived on that and I was into it. So it was kind of perfect. And then I did some free skiing contests and was like, okay, I'll do this for one more year. And then that just kind of turned into, I think I did free skiing contests and worked in restaurants for a couple of years. And then I got that call from Matchstick and that kind of launched that side of my career.
And I am curious about that. Did you like competing?
I did. I mean, I was always super nervous, but I think that's what I like. I like that feeling of, I think that's why we all kind of do it in a way, that feeling of I'm nervous. Can I do it? Can I pull it off? Stepping up to the challenge. And then that feeling you get when you actually pull it off.
Yeah. I mean, that's how I felt. And I also crashed a lot, which didn't feel great. And you're at the bottom and now you got to watch all your friends and you just want to go home. But that's part of it is that the highs and lows of competing are intense in the free skiing. Back then it was the free skiing world tour. When you and I competed, probably on some of the same comps, maybe even. And so you competed for years. And I think I read that you ended up getting on the podium 12 of the 14 competitions that you did. Is that right?
At a certain point. Yeah, that was my statistic.
And so obviously competing is what led you to Matchstick and all this. And so I'm guessing once you got into Matchstick, you didn't compete much anymore.
When I was competing, that was the thing. And then once I started filming, going back to contests, I was like, the motivation was not there.
I hear you. Cause what I didn't like, one of the things I didn't like about competing was you always was bad conditions and you're hucking your meat in conditions you normally wouldn't jump in but you got to do it today. And that was always, it felt a little bit off for me.
Yeah, totally. And I felt like a little bit of the reverse chip on my shoulder. Like I kind of felt like I had a target on my back. Like I only had the only where I could go was down because everyone's like, oh, she films with Matchstick, but she did terrible out there today. So it was all that, I just got in my head way too much after that.
I believe it. And to me, at least the natural progression is you work at the comps, you get recognition in the comps, then you start getting sponsors and hopefully get into the movies. And you mostly aren't going to go back to the comps because the comps are more risky for injury and all that. Because a lot of times the conditions, as we've talked about, are not very good. And so it's better to go filming where you're literally just trying to hunt out the best possible conditions so that you can really shine.
Yeah. Yeah. If you can pull it off, that's the way to do it. But the contests are incredible in terms of muscle memory, repetition, training, picking out lines, and then being able to go ski them. It's such a valuable experience. And that's what really made me the skier that I was at the time was doing all those contests and having that camaraderie. I mean, skiing with all the women and men where it was like, we had this great relationship with a lot of the women I skied with where I was like, what line are you going to ski? What line are you going to ski? Do you think I can do this? And we really talked it through and helped each other. And so it was a very healthy competitive environment as opposed to kind of that negative, like, oh, I'm not going to tell anyone where I'm going to ski. We just had a really good crew. And I think it lifted all of us up at the time.
And it's a tried and true formula, right? The best skiers and snowboarders from those competitions are the ones who do the best in the films. So I think all the things that you said, putting together your line and visual inspection, having a team, having people to bounce ideas off, all of that happens again once you're filming. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a tried and true formula and it's not for everybody. And I just personally didn't do well there, but the best like you did do well. And I think it translated into amazing film segments, as we know, especially considering all the awards that you've gotten. And then one thing I wanted to touch on is real quick is was your siblings. So you have these two brothers who I think both ended up following you to Squaw Palisades, and they both became professional skiers and snowboarders. So Arnie was a pro skier, Ralphie is a pro snowboarder. All three and all three of you went pro, and all three of you used dominating the competitive circuit to get pro. And so I'm just so curious. It's just a weird thing for outsiders to see. And so we got to know, was there something about your upbringing that pushed you all to become pro athletes, or was it just genetics or both? Or what do you think?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think we had that great, like really fortunate foundation of getting to go every weekend and having that example of parents who are really passionate about it and were going to do whatever they could to make it happen. I think that was a super valuable role model experience for all of us. And then also, I think when my brothers saw what I was doing, they were like, oh, well, that looks awesome. And then, you know, and Arnie, of course, got a real job. He was working for Vocal and he was a rep and doing different stuff for them in Colorado. And he like bought a house. He was like the responsible one. But then he ended up coming to Tahoe. Eventually, Ralph and I were there first. And then Arnie ended up coming to Tahoe. And then I think at a certain point, he was like, well, why am I like working at this real job when I could just be doing whatever, working in the summer, doing masonry work and skiing all winter like you guys are? So I think, yeah, just having that example of someone doing it that you're really close to, it's like a powerful pull.
It's just such an anomaly to have three outstanding athletes come from the same little family from the, you know, RV in the parking lot of Crystal Mountain. I love it. And then two of you went to Whitman, you know, the pro skier capital of the world. So I just think that that's so interesting. And why do you think your brothers, you and you're the leader of all this, which I think is so cool. And you paved the way. And why do you think your brothers followed you to Squaw Valley Palisades Tahoe?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that Ralph was, he graduated from Western in Bellingham and he liked Baker, but I think we all just kind of wanted to experience something else. And going to where your siblings are is a way to do that. You're like getting away, but then you also have a bit of a safety net there. So I think that was attractive for all of us. And I know that I was really psyched when they were both there and we could do Thanksgivings together. And we had some really epic family meals and holidays. And yeah, I think we were really close in a way where maybe we didn't share all of our most crazy intimate life details, but we just wanted to be in each other's orbits as much as we could.
Well, and that might explain it more than anything else, right? Just family's family. And if you can have that and live your dream, why not take that?
Yeah, totally.
I'd take that every time. I'd love to talk really quick about Shane McConkie. He was my personal favorite skier, an absolute legend. I used to see you guys together at Squaw. It was super cool for me. And I know he was a close ski buddy of yours. And you told us about your first big ski trip was with him in Bella Coola, Canada. When and where did you first start skiing with Shane?
It was on the first time I got invited out to go ski with Matchstick. And it was in the backcountry, probably like off of I-80 on Donner.
Oh, wow.
And I went into the backcountry with Scott and Shane and JT, and just like got into an avalanche. It was just like totally over my head, you know, but I was just awestruck. And I was so determined the whole day to just like, I really want, I think maybe the first day we filmed was actually at Squaw Palisades Tahoe. And then they invited me in the backcountry, but yeah, I mean, it was just a blur. I just remember being so in awe and such a feeling of, I better step up my game because look what these guys are doing.
And this was around 2004, I'm guessing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. And Shane was great as a mentor in that he would kind of give me help and tell me what to do, but he was not going to hold your hand or baby you. And he would tell it to you straight. And it was really awesome. If I was being a wimp about something, he'd be like, come on, Ingrid, you ski bad snow all the time at Squaw. Like this is, yeah. So just drop in, you've got this. And he would just cut right to the truth, cut through all the crap, cut right to the truth. But then he also was never a dull moment. He was always playing jokes or trying to make people uncomfortable, or he couldn't stand to just have like a normal, straightforward conversation.
I feel like he was always testing the limits and testing people.
100%. I mean, yeah. I remember being in South America one time and I ran into him. He was there on a separate trip and there's a bunch of people at the same bar and he's chatting with some guy and he was like, hey, Ingrid, come over here. And I walked over and he was like, hey, Ingrid, you told me you wanted to cheat on your boyfriend. So I thought that, and just like introduced me to this guy, but that was the way that he did it. I was like, no, what?
So awkward, but he just thrived
on making people squirm.
Oh man, because he got me. I was lucky enough for a short while to be on the Squaw Valley Free Ride team. You guys were all on. Remember they used to have that dinner every year? And so they had dinner with sushi or something, and we were all there. And you know, I muscled my way in to try to get some like one-on-one talk to Shane time. And he totally did that kind of stuff to me. It was just, he didn't even know me. You know, it was just, I walked away going, what if that was real? And what if that was not? I have no idea what just happened. And that's exactly what he wanted me to feel. You know, it was pretty cool.
Yeah, he wasn't just going to have small talk. He needed to connect. And his way of connecting was to immediately knock you off your feet and see how uncomfortable he could make you.
What did Shane mean to you?
He was a really larger than life figure, and I think helped me get into being a professional skier in the most kind and honest way. And that he was kind of like an older brother, like kind of looking out for me, but telling it to me straight, and such a great role model in life, and such a great reminder to not take things too seriously. Like one of the things I think about the most is where he said, you know, it's just skiing. We're not saving the world. It's just skiing.
I like that.
And it's so easy to get wrapped up in this. And it's like, oh, it's just skiing. Like, we're not saving the world. It's skiing. It's meant to be fun. And just bring it back to that.
I love that. I love it. And on that, in that vein of it's meant to be fun, do you have any other funny Shane stories you could share?
Oh my gosh, so many. We were in Portillo one time coaching a camp together. And he and Sherry were there with their baby when she was like a little baby.
Yeah.
And it was Ayla. My birthday. Yeah, Ayla. And it was my birthday, and it was a huge table. Like if you can imagine 30 people at this really fancy table, and they bring out a birthday cake and everyone sings happy birthday. And then they present me with this beautifully wrapped present. It's like fancy wrapped present. And I'm opening it in front of all these people. And it was one of Ayla's dirty diapers.
Oh God. actually a dirty diaper.
Yeah. Like actually a dirty diaper.
And you so and I funny. Know how bad those smell.
Yeah. But I mean, it was just really funny. Like nothing. Yeah. There's so many good, funny Shane stories. One time we had a thing where it was, you couldn't let the other person pay for your thing. That was like always a thing of like, oh, I've got this. No. Here's your money. I'm giving you this. Like, here's your $2 for the coffee or whatever. And so we'd go back and forth. And one time I was out skiing, I was like, man, my boot is feeling so uncomfortable today. What? And he had shoved like a wad of dollar bills down into my ski boots there was an ongoing back and forth of like, here's your $4 bills.
Sounds like he was just the most entertaining person to be around while at the exact same time being a huge pain in the ass.
Yeah, totally. But that's in retrospect, that's kind of what you want. You know, you want someone to keep you on your toes, but there's so many things where it's aggravating. Like I remember getting back from a day in the backcountry in Tahoe. And he was like, we're all out there all day skinning around the backcountry. He goes, well, I didn't even turn my beacon on all day.
Whoa. And he was serious.
He was serious. Like he knew there wasn't going to be any avalanches and he wasn't worried about it. And so he was like, and maybe he had forgotten and that was his way of joking about it or something.
Right.
But instead of being like admitting, it was like, ha ha, you guys, ha ha, I wouldn't have even saved you, or like, ha ha, I got you.
Yeah,
it's like, I didn't have my beacon on.
It was like, I tricked you.
Yeah. So it was very, anything like that, everything was a joke.
Yeah, I believe it. It's such an interesting character. I think the way you describe it is feels very valid to me that he was just larger than life. In my brief encounters with him, looking at him, there was more to him than just him. It was really an interesting person. So I want to jump into a couple of your ski expeditions, because you know, as free skiers, we don't generally go ski mountaineering. We don't generally ski high altitudes. But you skied Denali. You skied, I can't say the name of that 20,000 foot peak in China.
Red Domain.
Okay, thank you. And then you've also been to Gasherbrin 2 in the Himalaya, which is an 8,000 meter peak. So we can just kind of bang through this. What was it like skiing in Denali? You know, I guided Denali once in snowshoes. It was terrible. I had to hike down, but so I got to go back and ski it because it wasn't as fun as it could have been. But I'd love to hear, what was your experience skiing Denali?
It was amazing. We had a great team of people. It was one of those like where I got to go with Conrad Anker and Jimmy Chin and Hillary Nelson. I mean, it was like legend upon legend. And then they took a bunch of, I'd been on some high mountain expeditions at that point, and I'd been to 24,000 feet, there was some Sage Catabriga Alosa was with us and some less experienced people. So I was kind of in the middle, but it was just a big team from the North Face. And it was all about, the whole trip was about mentor mentee relationships and how we could all work together. And it was just a really great opportunity to be with an awesome crew. And we got super lucky. We were able to ski all the way from the summit right down, you know, there's that face right above 17,000 feet. And usually you come around the corner and you go through Denali Pass and down that kind of traverse, that really sketchy traverse. And we just got to ski that whole face straight back down to 17 camp.
Wow.
So we got super lucky with conditions and our team and the weather. And I know people have had heinous experiences on that mountain, but we lucked out so much, and we were in and out and skied the thing in under 2 weeks, I think.
That's impressive. Yeah. On my trip, we were stuck at 14 camp for 10 days.
Yeah.
I think Denali, that's more typical, right? I think Denali Pass is the coldest I've ever been. So then you also skied tell me the name of the peak again in China.
It's called Red Domain.
Red Domain. Okay. 20,000 foot peak. Yeah. It sounds like that was another insane trip. Was Jimmy Chin on that trip too, maybe?
That was with Jimmy and Kasia Rigby and Giulia Monego, who's an Italian skier and ski mountaineer. And, it's super remote, way out in the mountains in the Minnetonka range, which is a lot of really high peaks in China. There's a lot of great climbing and a lot of mountaineering, but the temperature fluctuations are huge.
Right.
There. So it's pretty sketchy. And we just got lucky. We went up the mountain. It was kind of, the weather was kind of getting worse the whole time, but Kasia kept placing these wands so we could find our way down. And by the time we got to the top, it was a full blizzard, but we had the wands to follow on the way back down, so we didn't get lost. There was some cruxy skiing, but just a couple of spots. And it was, again, a really, really cool experience. We got super lucky.
Sounds rowdy. And the snow was okay?
Yeah, the snow was actually great. Yeah, I've had some bad ones too. Pakistan was a very good learning experience and a super great cultural experience, but the actual climbing of the mountain did not go well. That was a bad time.
Yeah. Give us a recap on that. And that was Gasherbum 2.
That was Gasherbum 2. Yeah. And it was a North Face team, and we were going to go try to climb and ski Gasherbum 2. Had never been skied at the time. And we got there. I got totally sick. I'd brushed my teeth with some water in a hotel like earlier on. And I just didn't know I'd never been anywhere in Asia before. And out both ends, like super sick, hiking in to base camp for several. It was like a 7-day hike up the Karakoram, which was amazing. I mean, so gorgeous, absolutely incredible. You pass Triangle Towers, you pass all these really famous peaks. And then the base camp was stunning, but I just had started off kind of on the wrong foot. And then it was hard to get my energy back. And then the people we were with were so experienced, and they were just flying up and down the mountain. I was out of my league. And then by the time it came time for a summit push, they were like, we got to go now. And then we ended up getting stuck at 24,000 feet for a couple of days in a tent.
Really?
Just like digging out. Yeah.
How did you feel at that elevation for days?
Terrible. Yeah.
I
can't sleep at elevation. I can't eat. You're just kind of miserable for a couple of days. And then by the time we thought we had a summit push, the weather kind of came in and we tried for a summit. And then we ended up going down the mountain on the same day that everyone else was going up past us on this beautiful, sunny, perfect day. So it was kind of just, you know, one of those, but it was a great learning experience. I was getting down off the mountain was like the hardest thing I've ever done because everything was cramping. I'd been at the altitude for 3 days, hadn't really eaten. My body was basically shutting down, but I still had to get down the mountain. I was like tripping. My crampons were catching my, I couldn't even walk straight. I was like tripping and falling on my face.
And did you guys ski or you were just climbing?
We skied a little bit. Yeah. Skied a little bit. And then there's some really steep spots that if we had more time, we could have maybe set up a rappel. But at that point it was just like, we need to get off the mountain.
Yeah. It's time. It's time to go.
Yeah. We need to get down to lower elevation because everyone was really feeling it at that point.
Oh, wow. Yeah. So scary. Elevation is just terrifying. So much can go wrong so quickly. Thank you for sharing that. I wanted to talk to you about the Approach film because this looks amazing. I'm excited to watch it, but I don't know a lot about it. So your latest film project is called The Approach, and I believe it's about inclusion in the mountains. And so I'd love for you to be able to tell us a little bit about this film.
Yeah, it's a women-led, it's almost entirely film directed, produced, edited by women.
Oh,
and
wow.
It features, it kind of elevates and features adaptive skiers, people of color, and women.
Fantastic. And what were your goals with this film?
Well, the original concept started a couple of years ago, and it was kind of the original concept. I'm kind of embarrassed to admit, but it was called Tokens. And okay. It was about getting everyone who would maybe be one person in a skier snowboard film. That would be that kind of token person, like maybe the token adaptive skier, the token female, getting everyone together in a movie together so we could all kind of lift each other up. But then after 2020, the kind of racial reckoning, the term tokens was just really racially charged. And we didn't want to, I didn't want to conflate my experience as a very privileged white skier with the challenges that are faced by a lot of other people in greater society with the concept of tokenism. So yeah, we changed it to The Approach and we got a lot of amazing people on board. It was one of those things that just kind of happened naturally where one person led us to another person. We reached out to our friend Vasu, who I'd known Vasu Sojicha for many years. And we worked on, he skied with us for our lineage project when we had our first daughter and traveled around in a van. And so yeah, I've known Vasu for a long time and he connected us with some great people. And then it just ended up being an awesome group of people that came together to kind of lift each other up and support each other. And it's a mix of skiers and snowboarders. Skier, Vasu is a one-legged skier.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And two Black women, a skier and a snowboarder, Emily and Brooklyn. We kind of wanted a mix of people that were more established, like Leanne Pelosi. She's doing things differently where she's at the top of the game in the snowboarding world and she's been doing it for so long, but she can sled anywhere in BC. Like her skills on a sled in the backcountry are amazing. And when she first started, you know, 20 years ago, that knowledge was not handed down easily. Like it's such a macho thing. You had to keep up or you wouldn't make it. And so she really had to kind of fight and work for every scrap of that knowledge and that experience. And now she's turning around and really passing that along in such a different way. And she's brought a lot of women in and she's like, hey, I'll teach you how to sled. I'll help you. And she's just enabling the next generation of women skiers and snowboarders in that world to get out there and do it. And I think that's really what it's about. It's about handing on the knowledge in a different way and inviting and including more people in.
That's fantastic. I'm very excited to see this film. For our listeners, check it out, The Approach. I think you can just Google it and find it and it's showing. And then it'll be available online shortly.
Yeah, it'll be available online on November 23rd.
Okay, perfect. November 23rd of 2021. Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. I was really excited to learn more about that. The last question here is what's next? What's next for you and your life's journey, Ingrid?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I want to ski a lot. I want to ski with the family. That's one of my favorite things right now is skiing with my kids and my husband. And yeah, hopefully a lot of good skiing around Washington. And now that we can get back into Canada, hopefully get to go to Canada.
Yes.
I want to do more writing and just be creative and ski as much as possible.
I love it. I'm looking forward to all that, especially the writing. And on that note, reminds me as years ago in one of your ski movies, you said the word esoteric, talking about the ski culture. I don't know if you remember which ski movie that was in. And I remember watching that as a punk ski bum just out of college and going, what the hell does esoteric mean? Looking it up and learning it. And I swear to God, I use that word all the time. And whenever I use it, I think of you. So thank
that's
you for
awesome.
That. The only education I've ever got that actually, you know, mental education from a ski movie.
That's funny.
I appreciate that. Well, Ingrid, that's all I've got for you. Do you have anything else you'd like to add here at the end of the show?
No. Thanks so much, Miles. It was really great to talk to you. And I thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah. Thank you so much for connecting with me here. It was great talking to you. Thank you so much again. Have a great day. And thank you so much for balancing the kids and the dogs and all that together. Cause that also made it fun. It was cool to see your skill level with all that.
Oh, well, thanks for your patience. And I just appreciate your enthusiasm and what you're doing for skiing and just keeping the spirit and the fun in it. I appreciate that.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you again.
Thank you so much for listening to the Snow Brains podcast. If you liked this podcast, please share with your friends and family, and please subscribe. To find out more about Snow Brains, please visit us at snowbrains.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Snow Brains.
Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Tamarack Resort. For the free spirits that hear the call of the undiscovered and believe the future truly is boundless, Tamarack Resort is the place for you. And we can't wait to welcome you with arms wide open. Find it together at tamarackidaho.com. Today's Snow Brains podcast is brought to you by Scott Sports. Looking to test the boundaries but fearful of high-risk situations? Scott Sports knows the danger. That's why they've developed the Patrol E1 Avalanche Backpack, which is what I personally use in the backcountry. It's the ultimate free skiing avalanche backpack, pushing the boundaries of innovation. The supercapacitor technology, along with exceptional design, results in one of the lightest electric airbag backpacks on the market to date. To learn more, go to scottsports.com. This episode of the Snow Brains podcast was edited by Jared White, music by Chad Crouch, and I'm your host, producer, and creator, Miles Clark.